Tonight on Arena, we look at the albums and artists who inspired hip-hop, and Norah Jones, Jenny Beth and Codaline are the albums for review. You can text 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Last week, during our album reviews, the one album that stole the limelight came courtesy of Run the Jewels, a hip-hop duo whose passionate, articulate and angry commentary on America's relationship with its black population was incredibly timely given recent events. Well, for all its relevance in 2020, these issues go back many, many years, and they have been addressed by a wide variety of hip-hop and rap artists throughout the decades. But if you're interested in tracing the origins of hip-hop and its exploration of these themes, you could do no worse than go back five decades to 1970 and two seminal albums. Poet and songwriter Gil Scott-Heron and the New York trio The Last Poets both released their debut album that year. And in a moment, we'll be talking to Bonnie Greer about their legacy. But first, we'll have a track. This is the title track from Gil Scott-Heron's debut, Small Talk, on 125th and Lennox.
This is just like listening to a conversation being held by the many people who congregate on one of the most popular blocks in the largest area of black America. Did you ever eat cornbread and black-eyed peas or watermelon and mustard greens? Get high as you can on Saturday night, go to church on Sunday to set things right.
Bonnie Greer, you're very welcome again on Arena. That track, Small Talk, on 125th and Lennox, what a dramatization of a time and place in poetic form, isn't it?
Well, it actually, I mean, I love his work because actually people forget how witty he was. Very, actually, quite funny, because what was wonderful about it was that what he did was he said what we were saying among ourselves, and he said it out loud. And his sort of influence was Langston Hughes, who I've written a small book about. And Langston also said what black people, what we said amongst ourselves to ourselves, the way we talked about other people, the way we looked at things, and we said that to ourselves. So when the N-word comes out, that's how we talk to ourselves. And this was the first time that this had ever been done. And it makes you laugh with recognition. I was just sort of laughing through the whole thing, you know, talking about junkies and all of this. It's the street. It's how people talk.
And 1970 was a turning of a new decade following the extraordinary 1960s. There was civil rights legislation, but that was countered then by the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X before that. What was the atmosphere across Black America then?
I think for my generation, I mean, we were a huge generation. Gil Scott-Heron was born in Chicago, like I was. He was 6 months younger than me, almost to the day. So we come through this sort of same arc of history, the same kind of parents who generally their experience, my father's was the rural South, my mother was the urban North. And so the way we came up, though, was as children of television, as children of the media. We were the first generation of kids to actually be children. And so we were, we young black kids were also children. And so we were looking at TV, enveloping TV. And so when you listen to his lyrics, a lot of that is a reference to the sort of stuff we looked at. But you put that on top of 1968, when Dr. King was assassinated, and my generation, we were younger than the generation that had done the sit-ins and had ridden, you know, the freedom buses and all of that. We were much younger. And so we wanted to do something. We didn't want to listen to white people anymore, or our elders either. I mean, that was the most important thing, because we were all brought up to be quite respectful and respectable, and then to sort of turn on our elders, which is what we did. was a pretty revolutionary thing to do.
Now, interesting you say the word revolution, because revolution was a consistent theme for all these artists. Did they really genuinely believe that a revolution of one sort of another for black people was imminent or could happen?
Well, yes. I mean, when you're young, you believe. I mean, that's what you believe in. That's what you strive for. That's what you want for right now. You know, whether it happens or not is another thing. But yes, of course, we really, really did. And we wore our hair differently. I've started wearing my hair in its natural state. I haven't worn my hair in any other way for 50 years. And that was from that time. And we started wearing clothes, African clothes, what we thought was African clothes. And really started making music and art and paintings and dance that was a lot about not only our experience as African-Americans, but the experience of the street. We embraced what you would call the ordinary people. They were important to us and not those people who had been educated at universities or people who had gone to church. We were very, very interested in the people in the community. I worked for the Panther Party, serving breakfast for little children before I went on to my university studies. And that was really, you know, that was really important for me to be there. And that was my generation. And that's what we believed in at the time.
Yes. So there were the Black Panthers, which were a revolutionary group. Then there was the wonderful scene at the 1968 Olympic Games, where the two black athletes gave the Black Power salute. And then presumably there were all different layers of revolutionary thought going on in America at the time.
Well, there was for African-American kids in my generation was a desire to have a critique of the United States as much as possible. I mean, it was an anti-capitalist critique. It was a critique that looked at the origins of slavery, that looked at slavery itself. It looked at segregation. It looked at the church. It looked at sex. It looked at music. It looked at television, particularly the media, because we were brought up on television, so the revolution will not be televised. It still makes me laugh because he's actually throwing back at us all the things that we were brought up to believe in, the commercials. He just throws it right back at us. So the revolution was going to be about turning over the whole idea of America that we had been brought up to believe, which was to be pretty straight-laced and pretty church-going and, you know, straight up and down, and to be pretty respectable. The civil rights movement was respectable. It was church-orientated, and they were very good, respectable people. And after Dr. King was murdered, we thought, no, we're not going to do any of that. We're not doing it because respectful didn't get us anywhere. And going to church didn't get us anywhere. And listening to our elders didn't get us anywhere. Because if they could kill him, they could kill us. They could kill anybody. And we didn't. You know, it makes me smile when you hear this generation say defund the police. And we said off the police. I mean, we wanted to eliminate the police in bloody battles in the street. I'm not saying that that was the right thing to do. But that's where our minds were. I mean, you have the Black Panther Party meeting the then governor of California, Ronald Reagan, who ironically our generation knew as the guy who was a cowboy who sold soap on television. Then he became governor of California, and the Black Panther Party challenged him to a shootout on the steps of the Capitol at Sacramento, California, because he'd been a cowboy. And they had wanted to also exercise their Second Amendment rights as well. So that was my generation, really, to sort of throw over the tropes of entertainment, you know, Disneyland, all that, which we had been fed. And also to get rid of what our parents had told us about, you know, if you're a nice black person, nice Negro, you know, things are going to go all right for you. Well, Dr. King was a nice guy and he was dead.
So, Bonnie, let's listen to one. This is an extract from The Last Poets from When the Revolution Comes.
When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, guns and rifles will be taking the place of poems and essays. Black cultural centers will be forts supplying the revolutionaries with food and arms when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, White death will fall off the walls of museums and churches, breaking the line that enslaved our mothers. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, Jesus Christ is gonna be standing on the corner of Lenox Avenue and 125th Street, trying to catch the first gypsy cab out of Harlem. When the revolution comes.
That's The Last Poets and an extract from When the Revolution Comes. That sounds so modern and so, well, it's so appropriate to now, but it's just the way they present the words and what they're saying.
This is Rambo. This is France at the time of the commune. This is ancient and quite beautiful, and it's different because what we were saying back then was the revolution. And it was really about overturning everything that had gone before. And that is what revolution is. And that's what we tried to do. And I think now what I'm seeing is this is a revolution as well. And this revolution is being televised. But it's an inclusive, I think, hopeful, in the sense of hopeful and something happening kind of revolution.
Whereas, you mean what's going on today?
Yeah, I think people, and I think it's incredible, and I think people are coming together from all ethnicities in an interesting way under Black Lives Matter, and they're interpreting it in their own way, whereas in my time, that would not have been possible, and we couldn't see how any other ethnicities could be a part of what we were trying to do, because it was so deep-seated, it was so deep-rooted, it was so much about the ghetto, so much about oppression, that I think my generation felt first that it had to go internally and deal with things, and there wasn't any space for anyone else to be a part of it, which kind of is that sort of delirium that he has that you find in Rambo, which I'm positive you must have read him, in this sort of idea of, you know, losing yourself in the senses of your own situation, if I can say. And so we came up renaming ourselves, changing our hair. We had no media at all, so we were talking to each other. He was using bongos the way you would hear bongos being played by some old jazz musician on the corner. Well, yeah, you pick up those bongos from a 50s jazz musician and you reclaim them, you change them. We were really about change. We weren't about change, we were about revolution. We really thought and we really believed that we could take the United States of America and make it into something else and do it as quickly as possible.
You were talking about past generations being respectable, and there's also a lot in what the last poets say about calling out Black people who are being mm-hmm. scared of revolution mm-hmm. and accusing them of being too wrapped up in trivia. And the use of the N-word comes in there as well, mm-hmm. isn't it, trying to goad them to get involved?
Well, you know, I the N-word, first of all, the fact that it's banned in most instances, and Spike Lee got very angry with Quentin Tarantino for using it, and quite rightly so. But when it's used within Black music, and I want to say this very strongly, the nuance, the levels of meaning, the tone of voice, the speed of what's said, where it's placed, this is all quite intricate. And, you know, when Gil Scott-Heron and when The Last Poets do that, they use all of that sort of palette, which is very internal. And because of racism, because of segregation, that internal palette isn't out for the general population. It isn't present. It isn't available. But what he does in the poem and what he places in the poem is he's got the boldness and the love, really, to say it out loud and then dare you. You know, dare you to repeat it. Most people wouldn't. We weren't brought up to repeat it, but my generation said it. The hood, the gangsters said it. The junkies said it. And that's where he aligned himself.
Just Because by The Last Poets is a track from their debut album. And and again, it appeals to comfortable African-Americans not to ignore the cause just because they don't think the same issues affect them. We listen to a little bit of Just Because.
And because you think there's no cause to die for. Malcolm, Denmark, Martin,
justice,
all died
peace,
because they knew
justice,
what was the cause
peace,
causing all
justice,
of us to be exploited
peace,
and depressed.
Freedom.
I hope you get a cause
freedom,
to die for soon, because you're
freedom,
gonna die anyway, just because you're black. Yes, I hope you get right soon,
freedom,
so there won't be anything causing me
freedom,
to die because you didn't believe
freedom,
in our cause.
That's Just Because from The Last Poets, and I'm talking to Bonnie Greer. Bonnie, obviously these people have influenced so many modern artists, Childish Gambino, Run the Jewels. And do you find it frustrating that we're still dealing with the same issues? Or do you find, oh, isn't it fantastic that there's this new generation who are just, you know, who are taking on the fight? You can look at it in two ways.
Well, I love the persona of Childish Gambino. I Don Glover, I love that persona. And that is exactly what The Last Poets conjure. You know, when you're 18 years old, you think, it's going to happen tomorrow. Everything's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, when I look at these demonstrations, I think of myself at that age. And then I'm thinking, my goodness, that was 50 years ago. What? You know, you can't even contemplate 50 years when you're 20 years old, 22. It's impossible to contemplate it. So what The Last Poets is saying to African Americans and Black Americans are, by and large, a fairly conservative with a small C demographic. It makes me laugh when people like Trump accuse Black people are being involved with Antifa or radical groups. That's the last thing Black people are involved with, the average person's guy. It's actually hilarious. And so what he is doing, what the poets are doing, is telling people, okay, you got the American dream, you're still going to die, and you're probably going to die Black. So why don't you do something? Why don't you address the things that are going on in the world instead of thinking because you have a Chevrolet that everything is going to be fine, that you've got a red Mustang and you've got a girlfriend or whatever, a house, a lawn, and some barbecue mm-hmm. on the back. Everything's going to be cool. It's not going to be cool.
And do you think that the same applies today? You know, do you think people are becoming politicized, or is there still that very conservative African American community who are happy with the positive things about American society?
African Americans are Christians, and I'm saying that as a culture, not individually, but as a culture. They're Christians, and they believe in what the Bible says, the by and by. People are very happy that young people are out there, I'm sure. My brothers and sisters are very happy about their kids being out there. But African Americans are transcendent. We are transcendent people. And so we believe we will overcome. And we believe that we will overcome and we will succeed. And we don't need to tear down anything. We don't need to burn up anything. It will happen because we live righteously. And Gil Scott Heron, The Last Poets, is saying, yeah, that's fine. You know, yeah. But however, it's always contradicted by the reality of being a person of African descent, a Black person in the United States. They don't let you do it. So my feeling is, let's see what happens here. I think that what's going on now with BLM is of its generation. It's of its time. It's a social media phenomenon. It is a phenomenon of all of that. I feel very hopeful about it. I feel very happy about it. And you know, just looking at it and watching it, it's a new thing, but in a way, it's the old thing too.
You were talking about the humor in The Last Poets and in Gil Scott Heron. One huge event, the moon landing, took place the year before these albums were released. And the event that history tells us united the world in wonder. But Gil Scott Heron took a different view. Let's hear it. Whitey on the Moon.
The price of food is going up, and as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the Moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special, to Whitey on the moon.
Thank you. Whitey on the Moon, Gil Scott-Heron. I've been talking to Bonnie Greer about The Last Poets and Gil Scott-Heron, artists who both released their debut albums 50 years ago in 1970. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Time now for album reviews. With a billion Spotify streams under their belt, Codaline return with their fourth studio album, One Day at a Time. Nora Jones released her seventh studio album, Pick Me Up Off the Floor, and the Savages' leader, Jenny Beth, released her first solo album, To Love Is to Live, which she was partially inspired to make by David Bowie's death in 2016. I'm joined by Kate Brennan Harding and John Marr, who've been listening. We'll start with One Day at a Time from Codaline, their fourth studio album, which would have coincided with eight nights at Dublin's Olympia. Those shows have been postponed, obviously. Let's listen to the current single, Saving Grace.
When you're out in the open and you're tired of hoping, I'll be there in a moment, I'll be by your side. When you're scared and you're lonely, and there's no one to hold you.
That's Saving Grace, the single from One Day at a Time from Codaline. And I'm joined by John Marr and Kate Brennan Harding. Kate, Codaline are commercially successful with a huge fan base in this country, but they seem to elicit strong and often negative reaction from non-fans. Why is that?
Well, I suppose it's very straight up that I am definitely not a fan and I would never choose actively to listen to a Codaline album. So for this piece, it was really, really good to exercise this critical thinking thing, you know.
Why would you never actively listen?
I can only speak from... because for a long time, any of their music, I find it really grates with me. And it grates with me because I think it's music, emotional music by maths. It's emotional music by numbers. I think they're formulaic. I think they have found something where... they know that a large number of people will listen to something from commercial radio and it will just be on in the background and they'll recognise it and sing along. And this album to me is no different. It's exactly the same formula, tugging on emotional heartstrings. It doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't offer anything, anyone anything new. I think as well, like for me, with the Irish music scene, it is so ripe. It is so, like people are creating some amazing music. And the thing is, I will say that this album will appeal to so many people. It's gentle and not progressive. It's harmless. But for me, it's really important that more music gets heard. And Codaline, unfortunately, just get immediate radio play, which I don't think their music necessarily warrants.
John, do you agree with Kate? I mean, popular music isn't, you know, doesn't always have to be progressive, does it? I mean, it doesn't at all.
Popular music can be absolutely magical. I have to say, I agree with every single word that Kate has said there. And one word in particular stands out, and that's harmless. That's a perfect word for this album and for the other three albums that Codaline have made. It's completely harmless music. I mean, I shouldn't be offended by it. I am, though, and I can't help being offended by it. It's extremely beige. It's terribly pedestrian. It's sub-Coldplay drivel. At its worst, at its best, one could say that there is... you know, robust song construction, very good production involved, an ability with hooks, an ability to sort of reach a mass audience. I mean, I think Steve Garrigan and the other three guys in the band manage those. But from a critical point of view, I've just never... fallen for them in any way. I really struggle with their music.
But I can see that song, John, Saving Grace, being very popular. I'll come to you in a second, Kate, sorry. I can see that song, Saving Grace, being very popular in a stadium, for example, because it's very sing-along. There's lots of voice work. So I think it's, you know, I can see why it's easy on the ear and easy to participate in.
There's no doubt that this is a band from day one that have looked at arenas and stadiums and thought, we will try to write music that will work in those kind of environments. There's something quite calculated about it. There's something quite cynical about it. Now, I'm not necessarily saying the four guys in the band are super cynical, but there is a sense in terms of when they go into studio, they want this to appeal to a large audience. And there is nothing wrong with music appealing to a large audience. Some of the greatest music that's ever been made in the history of music has appealed right across the board. But that's great music. Unfortunately, this isn't. This is very safe. It's very ordinary. Of course, a lot of people are going to really enjoy this. But a lot of people also enjoy Ed Sheeran. A lot of people also enjoy the script. As a critic, I can't see anything good about it.
I think a lot of critics would like Ed Sheeran, though. I mean,
I haven't met too many, Kay, I have to say. But maybe I gather with a very cynical bunch. Perhaps Kate has met more kind critics than I.
Kate, in the blurb that comes with the Coda Line album, One Day at a Time, they talk about, you know, going back to basics, streamlining the process, as though it's a more intimate album, but I don't think you think they achieved that in this.
No, I think basic is the operative word. I think they are the most basic band in the country. And I'll probably have people firing off all sorts of things at me for saying that. But it's the thing that you can create. Ed Sheeran has created songs. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but Ed Sheeran has created songs that hit me, that move me. I wouldn't be a massive Ed Sheeran fan, but there are songs and melody that I really can grasp with. Coda Line, it is, every song is exactly the same. And John said the word beige there. I sent you my review earlier and I said it's an album of beige feelings. I think it's an exercise in emotional manipulation. And I don't know why they shouldn't make me feel so irked, and yet they do and always have done. And even reading their website, I'm like, every single thing about this is music by numbers. And I have to say, I've been a tutor in BIM, and some people that have come to me have had to choose the road where they've gone, okay, today I'm going to make something that'll fill an arena, or am I going to follow my heart and soul? And the ones that follow their heart and soul are the ones I'll get behind. But I think for the ones that want to fill arenas, off they go, but it's not going to be something I'm ever going to like.
But going back to what I've been reading, it seems like they are following their heart and soul.
Well, they might be doing that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the result is good. I mean, if you take the opening track, Wherever You Are, in terms of this huge production that's there, it reminds me of Coldplay and what they were doing around the time of the X and Y project and so forth. But Coldplay were doing it so much better, so much better.
Completely.
And like even something like Saving Grace, I mean, it's a pretty song, but it's also plodding and it's by numbers. And I have to say, and I've got a problem with the script frontman as well in doing this, but the mid-Atlantic twang that I sense from Steve Garrigan from day one, from High Hopes, the big song back in 2013 to now, that mid-Atlantic twang really grates on me. And as Kate said at the outset of this, this is a golden period for Irish music. There are some phenomenal artists out there that can barely keep it going in terms of making a living, particularly in this awful time that we're all through at the moment. Live music gone out the door. And this is a band that are attracting tens of millions of streams on Spotify and so forth. And good luck to them in a way. I doubt they're going to care what I think of their music.
Yeah.
But I would be completely remiss, Kay, in suggesting that it's in any way special. It isn't. I mean, I can say that, yes, it's well constructed and, yes, they know how to deliver catchy tunes, but it doesn't move me by a single scintilla.
Okay. I'm not expecting great stars from you, John, out of five.
No. Look, I'm going to be generous and give it two.
The mid-Atlantic twang. I thought, oh, God, that's a surprise.
I'll give it two stars.
And Kate, from you for Coda Line?
Well, I'm being generous and giving it one.
All right, I think you are, given what you said. One Day at a Time by Coda Line. Now, Nora Jones is back with her seventh studio album, Pick Me Up Off the Floor. Kate, hard to believe, but that massive debut album of hers, Come Away With Me, was released 18 years ago.
I know.
So how far have we come from this record? And this record in some ways isn't really, well, it's not a concept album anyway. It's a gathering of songs.
Yeah, like the thing is, so this is a gathering of songs and Nora has, I mean, her work is phenomenal. There's a lot of people would be naysayers about Nora Jones, and I've always been a fan. And I love when she does collaborative work as well, which she has spent the last 4 years doing because she didn't want to actively get back into an album release cycle. So with this album that she's just released now, Pick Me Up From the Floor, the title itself is around the fact that she had a lot of songs left over from collaborating. She also started to write poetry because she's a music-led artist. She's always written the music first and added lyrics in afterwards. This entire process was about her writing poetry and finding songs that she had, they hadn't been released, they were just practice songs, and sitting with them. So she said that she sort of spent a lot of time listening to them roughly on her phone around her house. And more so, she began to see how they could cohesively come together as an album. So in doing this, she worked completely differently and she worked with the likes of Wilco's Jeff Tweedy. They've related one of the songs on the album called I'm Alive is beautiful. But simply put, she is, you cannot deny as soon as she opens her mouth, you know it's Nora Jones. It's a Nora Jones record, but it's kind of come a long way in terms of it's looking at global issues and it's looking at them from an outrospective point of view, from a feminine point of view. It's also got she's always been very sexy, has always got a very sexy sound to it as well. I think she's grown hugely because she was allowing herself a bit more freedom from removing from the album cycle with it.
OK, well, let's listen to one of the tracks. This is I'm Alive.
But she's alive, oh, she's alive. She's alive, oh, she's alive.
That's I'm Alive from Pick Me Up Off the Floor from Nora Jones. John, as Kate said, these songs were written at various different points over the last 18 years. Does that make a coherent album?
On paper, it shouldn't. And yet, in a way, it does, in that there's a sequence of three songs in the centre and they're all built around the idea of life. This Life, To Live and I'm Alive are their titles. And they're weirdly prescient for the world that we're in at the moment. I mean, you've got a lyric talking about when the world implodes. Another lyric from a different song, This Life As We Know It Is Over. And Nora Jones herself in an interview has suggested that they're kind of freakishly apt for this very strange 2020 that we're having. They do work to a degree. I would agree with Kate in that I think her voice is absolutely sublime. I think at times I snooze a little, though. They can feel quite samey. I would also agree that when she collaborates with people, she can really challenge herself. I mean, there's some beautiful collaborations out there with Belle and Sebastian, for instance, that I adore. And the really good songs on this album are really good. But there are some that, you know, I'm happy to just skip along.
And Kate, what about the musical layering? Obviously, the piano is central because she's such a wonderful player. What other musical elements are there? And what kind of genres does she cover?
Well, this is the thing. So the Nora Jones genre is, you know, that soulful jazz, and her piano playing is inherent throughout. But she also incorporates very gently, whether she incorporates trumpets, she's incorporating violin. She almost has a country, obviously with Jeff, she has a country sound and twang. There's a folksy, bluesy element. And all the while she allows, like I always think, sometimes people when they sing, their voice just stands out and the music is accompanying it. With Jones, I think the music and her voice are all weaved together as one. And so it's kind of difficult when you start picking apart the layers. I agree with John. Some of the songs would be a little bit of the same, same. But I think as a body of work, but the more I listened to it, the more I wanted to listen to it. So like my first listen, I was like, okay, it's a Norah Jones album. And then the second and third listen, I was really delving deeper into the musicality of it. And yeah, like I think there's probably two or three songs that maybe could have been reworked or something. I found it kind of interesting as well. She uses reverb guitar very well on the song Flame Twin, which is a really sensual kind of song. And I could hear somebody taking that song and reworking it into a rock and roll track, whatever the melody was in it. But yeah, like it's just, it's her voice is the main draw in. And then you got to kind of hear all these stories elsewhere.
And I have to say, you know, that is a good thing in terms of she is very aware of what her primary gift is. And that is that absolutely exquisite vocal. And one of the curious things that I felt listening to this was just a hankering for live music, because I'm not necessarily going to choose to put on a Norah Jones album when I'm at home. But I would love to see her perform these songs in concert in an intimate setting with a really fantastic bunch of players that she has assembled on this album. I think it would be really good.
So, John, can I just press you for stars, please, out of five for Norah Jones?
A solid three from me.
A solid three. And from you, Kate?
I gave it 3.5 out of five.
Okay, 3.5 and 3 out of 5 for Pick Me Up Off the Floor by Norah Jones. And finally, we have To Love Is to Live by Jenny Beth. John, Jenny Beth fronted the Savages. Why has she chosen to go solo, do you think?
Well, it's been the Savages are a fascinating band, and they had a Mercury nomination back in 2013. It's been 4 years since their last album. But the thing about them is that it was always a sense that Jenny Beth was central and pivotal to everything that was great about them. And just for people that may not be familiar with her, she is a French lady, real name Camille Berthomier. She moved to England in her 20s, and she has gone it alone. And on the evidence of this album, I'm very glad she has, because it's a really, really interesting collection of songs.
Okay, let's listen to this track, which has great energy and great anger. It's called I'm the Man. That's I'm the Man, To Love Is to Live from Jenny Beth. As I said in the introduction, Kate, she was inspired, she said, partially by the death of David Bowie and his last posthumous album, Black Star. Is that obvious from the first listen for you?
Well, you know what? It's kind of funny because, like, I am a massive Savages fan, and I have, like, been lucky enough to see Jenny Beth perform at Savages at Body and Soul. I can safely say that she's one of the most mesmerizing, enigmatic performers I have ever seen in my life. And I put her up there with Bowie. Like, I've seen Bowie and seen Iggy Pop, and Jenny Beth is up there in terms of how she captures the audience. When I listened to this album for the first time the other day, I was actually driving and I hadn't done any research at all. I just was reading or listening. And my immediate thought, once it hits into the second track, I was like, gosh, I think she's really like going after that Black Star sound, that in delving into your own psyche. She uses trip hop beats, she uses jazz, and obviously then she's got her punk kind of post-punk energy coming in. And then I read that actually she was completely inspired to create her solo work because Bowie had died, and she was like, well, I better get myself up and out and go and do this. And she was inspired by him, by the message, and by creating, going inside her psyche and seeing the various characters that she has in her head. So it was like, it's really obvious to me, even her use of using poetry throughout. Romy from the XX, she was also pivotal in getting Jenny to realise that she could be the heroine of her own
world and that she could be the heroine instead of singing about other people, that she's the heroine within. So that's why this album is very much all characters that she feels are part of her identity.
Do you think you agree that it's... John, that it's
sorry,
a development.
Kay, if I could, there's a wonderful song on this called French Countryside. It's wistful, it's dreamy, and even before I read about the Bowie connection, I thought this sounds quite like Dollar Days from Black Star. That kind of the elegy of it. It's a beautiful song, and you put on Dollar Days, and there's certainly a similarity, and one can sense how inspirational that album has been. And I have to say thank heavens for that, because it's a remarkable work, a piece of work. I mean, Kate mentions poetry there. You've got Cillian Murphy that appears in this album, and he's done a beautiful rendition, recitation of one of Jenny Beth's songs, verses called A Place Above.
Sorry, John, I have to get Stars from you now because we're just going to take a call after the next break. So Stars out of five.
Four stars.
Four stars. And from you, Kate?
Yeah, it's 4.5 out of five. Nearly the five from me.
Very good. That's for Jenny Betts. To Love is to Live. John Marr and Kate Brennan Harding, thank you very much. The winner of this year's Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction was announced just a few minutes ago. I'm delighted to say that it's Christine Dwyer Hickey for her novel The Narrow Land. The Narrow Land explores the complex relationship of Joe and Edward Hopper, the American artist who painted the iconic late-night diner scene Nighthawks. Edward and Joe lived in Cape Cod during the hot summer of 1950, where the action in The Narrow Land take place. And Christine joins me now on the line. Christine, congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much, Kay. Thank you. I'm delighted with myself.
I'm sure you're delighted with yourself. How surprised were you when you got the call?
Shocked.
From the...
I nearly had a heart attack. I was really shocked. I mean, the book has been out since it was published in March 2019. And I'd sort of given up on any hope that it might be a prize winner. And then it got shortlisted for two big prizes. And I won this one. I was just so pleased. I just couldn't. I couldn't get a hold of it. You know.
Yes, because it's fantastic that they have chosen you, because it's your book is about history, because it's talking about the some negative results of World War II, and then the art history of Edward Hopper. So it's a very exciting choice.
It's fun, it's different, I suppose. I mean, it deals with the creative. It was kind of interior and exterior, trying to get into his head and his creative life, and also what 1950 Cape Cod was like, just after the Second World War, and when American consumerism was at full throttle, and they were recovering from the Second World War. So that was an interesting time, I thought. That was, and I'm so glad I didn't put it into 1960 or 1970. Now I wouldn't have been.
Well, the judges called it a quiet tour de force, placing art at the heart of historical fiction.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And you're having some year, aren't you? Like Tati is chosen for the Dublin One City One Book, and. But unfortunately, then COVID-19 got in the way.
I know. It's been very lucky on the one hand, but on the other hand, as you said, the COVID-19. I mean, there was One City, One Book, and then this thing today, and a shortlisting for the Dalkey Literary Award as well. And they're brilliant things, And I'm not going to complain. I know I could have made more of it if we were free to do what we wanted and everything was going on, particularly with Tati. There was something like 21 events, and most of them would have to be shelved anyway. But what can you do? I mean, that's just the way it is now, and just grateful that none of my family have been ill, or when you think of what people are going, some people have gone through. I'm not going to complain. I'm still very, very happy.
And Christine, were you happy with the response to The Narrow Land up to this?
I felt in the UK it was kind of overlooked, it slipped under the radar. I mean, it was a review in the TLS, but I don't think there was reviews anywhere else. I don't know. It just seemed to, which was unusual, because my previous four books had got a lot of critical acclaim and reviews and stuff in the UK. But this just seemed to slip under the radar. So I was a bit disappointed, and then I let it go. And then suddenly then my luck starts to turn. So there you go, you know.
And I mean, the intricateness of the writing, to try and write a book through the eyes of an artist. And it must be so gratifying to see that the Walter Scott judges saw that.
Yeah. I think in a way, the most difficult character, there's lots of characters in it, but I do it from three points of view. Edward Hopper, his wife, Jo Hopper, and a little boy, a little German refugee, who was brought over to America on President Truman's directive that wanted to rescue as many unclaimed, if you like, children that were just wandering around or in holding camps in Germany after the Second World War. He's so different to President Trump, but anyway, you know, just that was difficult to get into his little mind. A five-year-old orphan that had seen some horrific things, and that idea of the inheritance of guilt. And how do you come back from that? You know, he doesn't know why he feels guilty. He can only half remember things. But there's a certain amount of resentment towards him because he represents the German nation, you know, within 1950, only a few years after the war in Cape Cod. So that was kind of tricky enough. You know, you have to get into his little head. So, but you know, that's what you do. I just did it bit by bit and hoped for the best, and it gradually grew.
And Christine, what will this award do for the book? Will this give it another push now?
It'll give it a big push, I think, in the UK.
Yes.
Definitely in the UK. I think there's particularly readers over there have great regard for the Walter Scott Prize. So I think it will help a lot that way and bring more readers to it. So
and winning a prize like this, will this free you up to what is your current project, or are you writing on working on a book at the moment?
I had the bones of a novel, and I thought to myself with lockdown, oh sure, I'll get a good one with this. And then I got waylaid. I was just writing a simple paper about the childhood of James Joyce, and sure, got completely out of hand, and I'm not up to my ears in research on it, and I could write a book on it now, you know. But so I don't know. I'll go back to the novel, I think. This has given me a bit of confidence, I think, to go back and look at the novel I was working on.
Absolutely thrilled for you, Christine.
Oh, thanks, Kate. Thanks a million.
Christine Dwyer Hickey winning the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction. And The Narrow Land is published by Atlantic Books. That's it for tonight's arena. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. The programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Sean is back next week.